Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. This week, I have the distinct pleasure and honor of being joined by Dr. Julia Haller from the Wills Eye Hospital. We discuss her career, moving from Johns Hopkins, University of Wilmer Eye Institute to Wills Eye Hospital, her connection to Tom Clancy and the character Jack Ryan, and what kind of are her goals and kind of the things we face as a field moving forward into the 2020s and beyond. As always, a list of financial disclosures will be attached in the episode description. And you can find links to go to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website and claim CME credits for this and other podcast episodes. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is honored to be joined by Dr. Julia Haller. Dr. Haller is world-renowned and currently serves as ophthalmologist-in-chief at the Wills Eye Hospital in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. She's past president of the Retina Society and has numerous other accolades. Dr. Haller, welcome back to the program and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Jay. It's great to be here. I'm honored.
So I had you on before and we talked about the legal case, the Melgen case a couple years ago. And then I got a lot of feedback from people and they said, you know, you always bring guests on. You talk about their backgrounds and why they became ophthalmologists. And you didn't have that conversation with Dr. Haller. And that wasn't really the purpose of that last call. But we're going to talk a little bit about this now. So for the listeners, we have a lot of younger listeners who are interested to kind of know the background for people. Why did you become an ophthalmologist? And then why did you decide to do retina?
Well, I've always loved fixing things. And so I think I was drawn naturally to surgery. I liked the technical aspects of it. And I liked the team spirit. I've always enjoyed being on teams too. So maybe there was something about suiting up and being with a team all together in the operating room. And I enjoyed taking care of men and women and all ages. And so I kind of lucked into ophthalmology. My dad was chief of pediatric surgery at Hopkins, and he suggested I might want to come down and do a rotation in ophthalmology. He said he noticed all the ophthalmologists seemed to really always be happy. And that indeed played itself out. So I did a summer rotation, a way rotation at Wilmer. And I worked with Stuart Fine, and I loved it. So I ended up, but I actually, by the time I got to ophthalmology, I was already pretty late in my medical school career, as happens to so many people, by the way, and particularly underrepresented minorities. And so I'm in sympathy with this, because if you don't go into medical school knowing you want to go into ophthalmology, you have to kind of luck into it. And the only way to really know about it is to have friends or you know, family members. But anyway, I was on a general surgery track, and I actually did my internship in general surgery, because by the time I finally did decide to go into ophthalmology, it was the summer before my fourth year, and I had to really scurry to get my applications in. And I ended up, this is before the match as we know it today, but I ended up getting accepted into the Wilmer residency on the condition where I wanted to be, because my husband was there, if I did a research year. So I kind of had an extra year. And so I spent that, my internship and my research year, trying to make sure that I was 100% sure I wanted to go into ophthalmology, because my backup was that I would do, I would go back into a straight surgical track. So I had a little bit more of a winding pathway that maybe would have been ideal, but I learned a lot along the way, and you know, just by so much luck and good fortune, I ended up in the very best specialty you could possibly have, one with the least burnout, where you have the most satisfaction and incredibly high impact on patient outcomes and welfare.
So Wilmer is a great place now, was a great place then, and there were some big names, and big names are big names, but there are also tremendous personalities and teachers you encountered at Wilmer in the Department of Retina. You mentioned Stuart Fine earlier, but you know, there's Michaels was there at that time. You trained with some of the very best around you, who were your classmates or ahead of you or behind you. Who were kind of your biggest influence and mentors as a fellow, and then I know you served as chief. And what's your favorite Dr. Bill Smitty story, as I'm calling from Bascom Palmer? Because I know he was a resident when you were chief.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, well, so that's just so many questions that I'm just filled with about a zillion answers that could drag your podcast on into the evening. But, well, I mean, obviously one of the reasons I picked retina was because of Ron Michaels. And he was charismatic, a virtuoso surgeon, and one of those people that everybody wanted to be like. The first time I think I actually did retina surgery was when I helped out in the operating room. I was a first-year resident, and Gene DeWan was a third-year resident, and Gene called down to get me to come up and help him do something in the operating room. I think he needed an assistant. And it was a very cool case, and I don't remember all the details because I was overwhelmed. I mean, I had no idea what was going on, kind of, you know, because you're just starting out and you're trying to figure out what's going on inside the eye, and there was a foreign body, and he had forceps, and there was all this stuff, but it was so exciting. So that was those are two people who probably had influenced Gene more as a peer. Gene and Paul Sternberg was in that class too. I have benefited hugely from what some people have referred to as peer mentors, you know, people that you worked with and admired various aspects of the way they approached medicine. Emily Chu was a fellow at Wilmer, Rick Ferris. Dr. Patz, Arnold Patz was the chair at the time. You know, they were just incredibly talented people. A lot of what I learned about how to manage complications of anterior segment surgery, I learned from Walter Stark and Ed Mommany. There were a lot of people who you could pick so many tips here and there and then put together your own approach to patients and to surgery and other things. So that was really great. And then moving forward, I mean, Dr. Tasman actually was my board examiner and invited me to be on the retina subspecialty day committee when they were first starting subspecialty day and the academy first took it over. And that was a huge leg up at that point in my career, you know, sort of onto a national platform. So, who would think that years later he would pass the torch to me as ophthalmologist in chief at Wells? So it's that's how life is, really, isn't it? There are all these interesting twists and turns. Now about Bill Smitty. Bill, let's see what story could I mean, Bill. One funny thing, I remember one of the junior residents or first years, or even it might have been a medical student, was walking by Bill's office down in clinic. I mean, I say office, you know, his examining room where he was talking to a patient. And they came over and they said to me, "Bill sounds exactly like Dr. Michaels." And Bill had patterned him almost after Ron, that he was, it was almost as if, you know, Bill's mouth opened up and Michael's speech came out. So he was also very influenced, as all of us were, by Ron. But I loved it that he was able to actually sort of assume the persona. Bill's, by the way, even as an early resident, was one of the most talented surgeons I've ever seen. I mean, just, you know, one of those surgeons that just sits down, does his first cataract, and you're just going, okay, all right. The future is very bright.
So, you know, I would be remiss, and I feel like I didn't mention this to you when we were talking about doing this episode, but I'm sure you've been asked this question numerous times. We have to have listeners out there who have read Tom Clancy's books, and he's was a donor to Wilmer Eye and was someone who was local to the area. Tom Clancy obviously wrote several kind of these political action thrillers that were turned into movies starring this character Jack Ryan, and Jack Ryan first dates and then ends up marrying and having a family with Kathy Ryan, who in his books is an ophthalmologist at the Wilmer Eye Institute. And she's been played in media in various movies by various actresses, from Gates McFadden to Ann Archer, Bridget Moynihan, Keira Knightley, Abby Cornish most recently. And there are rumors that she was based on you. Right.
Yes. Well, that's
so,
true. And
so was yes. How did this? How did was she actually inspired by you? And how did this friendship come to be? And what is the kind of the funniest story you can tell in relation to that quote unquote inspiration that he used?
Well, so it was a long and winding path, and Tom Clancy started off as, I mean, I don't know if people are familiar with his history, but he was born in Baltimore. His dad was the mailman for Hopkins, so he lived over on Castle Street. And the reason Hopkins is portrayed so admiringly is because that's how he sort of grew up in the shadow of the dome and you know, admired the physician there. He also grew up really admiring the brave warriors who put themselves in harm's way to protect the citizens of the United States. And he had access to a lot of the Navy people because of where he lived. And he later lived further south in Maryland, closer to Annapolis. And he used to hang out down there and he'd meet people in bars. And they loved him because he had this brain that was a sponge and it sponged up all these details. And he hung on their every word, and he you can see him incorporating that into his books. He told me once that he saw himself, and he said this very modestly, so don't take it the wrong way, but he saw himself as a latter-day Homer, kind of singing the minstrel who sings the songs of the warriors. And of course, he didn't mean that his prose was as deathless as Homer's, but you could see. You know, it was all about them. It wasn't about him, is what he meant by that. And so he had, but he sold insurance. You know, that's what he had to do to make ends meet. And he didn't like that. And, you know, he had dreams of writing the great novel. And he started off with a book called The Hunt for Red October. And he wrote that book when I was maybe in high school or college. Mm-hmm. It took a long time to get it published. The character was Jack Ryan. As you know, it's a great movie, too, if people have seen it, but it's about a rogue Russian submarine captain who wants to defect to the United States. And, of course, the United States thinks he's attacking them when he goes rogue and comes toward the United States. And then Jack Ryan is the one who saves us all and figures out a clever way to get the guy to defect and get the boat. And it's based on this quiet, it's called a quiet screw, a silent screw, meaning the propeller on the submarine is quiet. And actually, apparently, that was something that really was in development in the Navy. And so it's kind of a, you know, there's this little frisson of top secret information that's in all the Tom Clancy books because you feel like you're really seeing behind the curtain a little mm-hmm. bit. And he had in that book, he had a wife named Kathy Ryan, and she was at Wilmer, but I was in my infancy as an ophthalmologist, and it really wasn't originally based on me, and she was a very minor character. But then it's a good story about what happened with that. He finally got it published by the Naval Academy Press. The Naval Academy Press publishes things like a small series of books on famous Navy people, you know, John Paul Jones and things like that, biographies, or charts of the Chesapeake Bay, you know, not bestsellers and not big runs of books or anything like that. But he sold Hunt for Red October to them. They published it, and it came out in a small number of books. And right when Ronald Reagan was at the height of his popularity, and Barbara Walters, the TV interviewer and star, was at the height of her popularity, she interviewed in primetime TV, Ronald Reagan, and her last question was, "What book do you have on your bedside table?" And charming Ronald Reagan said, "You know, it's the darndest thing. Somebody gave me this little book. It's called Hunt for Red October by some guy you never heard of, Tom Clancy, and I can't put the darn thing down." And by the next morning, it was they were sold out at the Academy. A couple days later, it was sold to Penguin Press, or, you know, a big New York firm. They put out thousands and thousands of books, and it was number one on the bestseller list.
This was the 80s equivalent of going viral, is what you're saying.
Yes, it was as close as you could get to go.
Right.
Today we would say going viral. So anyway, this guy who really didn't like being a insurance agent was suddenly a best-selling author and, you know,
that's
catapulted
so
onto all the, you know, Good Morning America or whatever the shows were at the time. I don't think Oprah was up and running yet at that point. But, yeah, she was probably just a newscaster in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
But so then he came out with Red Storm Rising, which didn't have much ophthalmology in it either. But then Patriot Games. And by Patriot Games, I was actually at Wilmer, and so people were starting to say to me, you know, I live down the street from Tom Clancy, and I know he wrote the book about you, and it's so cool. And then people would say to him, oh, you know, I went up for an appointment at Wilmer, and I met Julia Haller, and I know, you know, she must be the one that he based your book on. So finally, Chip Mason, who was head of the Hopkins Medicine Board at the time, said to Mort Goldberg, who was at that point chair at Wilmer, you know, this is ridiculous. We really need to get them together. So we invited him over for lunch at the Institute. And so we were just thinking it was a friendly lunch. And he comes in with two or three lawyers. And suddenly we realized that, you know, maybe he thought that there was a patent me. Or
oh, that you were going to sue for like some likeness,
yes.
Sort of. Oh, that's interesting. Wow, that's a great story.
So it was super awkward, and he, you know, his back was a little up and things like that. So anyway, we sat down and we started talking. Anyway, it totally turned around. We totally hit it off. The lawyers went home. We stayed and talked for hours.
Okay, good.
And after that, she became more like me and more like, you know, my friends there too. So in like Clear and Present Danger, well we were at the at the
That's interesting because I read all of his books as a kid. Her description does change from book
mm-hmm.
to book. She starts, it's a very different sort of depiction of her after, probably as you said, Clear and Present Danger was the big change, right?
It was, yeah, it was after, it really switched with Patriot Games. And then
right.
And then in the movie, she really became a retina person. And that's when they called me up and asked me if I would help with the movie. And and of course, I wanted to totally advise. I tried to persuade them to come to Baltimore and film it there, but they ended up doing it on the Paramount lot for budget reasons. But I did advise on costuming and things like that, and that was with Ann Archer. So she was the first. Let me just say that all five actresses who have played me have been fantastic, have been gorgeous, and don't look anything like me at all. Like Keira Knightley, me, no. You know, but they've all been really great, and I think the story's got better and better. And he also patterned it more after the real Hopkins, so the chairman became Bernie Katz, you know, instead of Arnold Patz. And John
Bernie
told
Katz.
Me about them.
Oh, that's true. I never thought of that.
And my husband John was doing some laser calibration that made it into like a subplot. And then later on he ended up buying the Orioles with a consortium that included mm-hmm. Peter Angelos and Pam Shriver and people. And so we were in his box. It was the day after opening day. And he said, okay, I've got the proofs in for the next book. And we're like, and he said, well, you're up for the Lasker Award and you also become First Lady. And I went, what?
Right.
Whoa. So you know, he had a million stories, and one of the really fun things was exactly what I said earlier about how he had sort of all this insider knowledge. So he was telling, we had just gotten the voice on the elevator that said, you know, third floor, fourth floor, fifth floor. And there had been a whole bunch of different voices that they'd gone through trying to pick what would be a good voice for the elevator. And I was telling him that. And he said, oh, well, that's the same thing in the military. He said when they first built the F-16, they had these fighter jocks on it. And they thought it was cool to go around corners really fast and pull all these G's and almost pass out. That was like a little stunt that these, you know, testosterone enriched, super fast, the right stuff type pilots like to do. And so they decided they couldn't do that anymore because if they passed out, you know, they would, A, they would die, and B, millions of dollars of taxpayer money would explode on the desert floor. So they put a little trigger on it with a voice telling them to pull up, but they made the huge mistake of picking this sexy, throaty female voice, like sort of Kathleen Turner, you know, like, pull up, big boy. And so that incentivized them. And they started doing it more just to trigger the sexy voice just for, you know, just for laughs. And so they had to switch and, like, get some nerdy male voice. So he had so many stories like that. I mean, this isn't a funny story, but when the Yamshin Rikyo group put the gas, sarin gas, in the Tokyo subways, I happened to see Tom. He happened to be over that later that day. And as soon as I saw him, I went, oh, my God, Tom, what's the story? You must know all about sarin gas. And, you know, he was just the kind of guy who could tell you how it was developed during the war and how it was originally American, but then they abandoned it, you know, and I mean, he was full of plenty of stories like that.
So you were at Willmar for essentially your entire academic career. Hopkins was your home. You grew up near Hopkins. You grew up as a part of Hopkins. And then the opportunity comes to move to Philadelphia and transition to Wills, which has its own rich history. Not an easy decision to make, but a big move that you made. Tell us, the listeners, a little bit about that transition, what kind of motivated you, and then what are the things you're most proud of that have happened at Wills since you've been there? And what do you see going forward for the Institute, one of the leading institutes in the country, as we kind of move forward into the 2020s?
Well, it was when I got a call. I just got out of the operating room and an executive recruiter called, and I said, well, I just, you know, I'm perfectly happy now. Thanks. No can do. Mm-hmm. And then one of my old friends called and I said, you know, it's so funny because I just got a call from the Wills executive recruiter and they went, that would be a perfect job for you. And I went, what? They went, absolutely. Call him back right now. So I went, okay. And I called him back. And then they talked to me about it a little bit more. And then I started to think, you know, what would this opportunity be for me? And I made it into the first round of interviewees, and I came up, and the more I looked around, the more I talked to people about what they were looking for, and the more they were telling me what the problem, you know, how they wanted to do this or fix this, and I mean, there was nothing broke, okay? I mean, it was the opportunity of a lifetime to lead one of the top places in the world. And what they were looking for and what they felt like they needed, I thought, well, that I can do that. That's in my skill set. And I kind of took the leap of faith. I mean, I had the support of my husband and my family, and you know, we just kind of went for it. And it turned out to be an incredible decision. And you know, a funny thing was that so much of Willis had such a private practice base then, and so many people said, well, this is going to be so different for you, a freestanding eye hospital versus working in the context of a big, big, big research university. But it really wasn't such a big switch. I mean, everybody had trained at the top places in the world, many of them at places where I'd been, you know, a year before, a year after I had been there. And people wanted to take the best care of their patients and do really mentoring and teaching and writing papers and doing research. So it was not as big a jump as you might have thought, but it was great. And so, let's see, what were my other questions? What's happened to Wills since then? Well, I think we've just gone from success to success. Not that there aren't challenges. I mean, all of us face so many challenges in the healthcare environment, and I think, you know, with the election and election discussions, we're all nervous about how things are going. But it's been a fabulous experience here. We've been able to really recruit some wonderful people from senior people to junior people. We've been able to establish an academic full-time track here, which has relieved people who really care about making a big part of their lives teaching and research, has relieved some of the financial pressure on those people. And we've been able to raise money. We of course, we need to do more of that always. But I think we've made big strides here and kept pace with ophthalmology in general in terms of lots of exciting things that are happening throughout the specialty. It continues, by the way, to be the best specialty in all of medicine. So again, for those lucky enough to get into it, I mean, that one of the things we're looking at now is how can we get more underrepresented minorities and people who don't have connections with ophthalmology to go into, because you really have to find out relatively early. I mean, for me, I had a total change, and it was my fourth year of medical school already. So I had to do an extra year. Not everybody has the opportunity to do an extra year. And fortunately, I'd been kind of heads up about tuning up my CV before that. But if you know, if you're somebody who comes in, you want to go back in the community and do primary care, you know, you may not realize that you're going to have to set aside another couple weeks to get those board scores up into the very, very highest range, because you've got to do that. And if you don't realize it early on, you can't go back. So, and writing papers, and, you know, just it's the bar is very high for ophthalmology, and anybody who works hard and is smart enough to get in medical school can do it. But it just, you have to be heads up about it, as you know so well, Jay. Well, I'm talking to somebody who's one of the most heads up, biggest CV people at his career stage, probably in the history of the world. So
no.
You found that out. You realized that early. But we need to get the word out, so because we need to be have physicians who are taking care of patients who represent the populations we serve.
That's a great point. And I think that what you referenced has become somewhat of a self-feeding cycle, right? If there aren't role models who people can look up to, or there aren't mentors, and if you're not having access, because I think ophthalmology is one of the highest rates in medicine of people following in their parents' footsteps who are ophthalmologists. And I think it's probably, again, because ophthalmology is a great field, their parents are happy and they tend to follow. So there's a little bit of self-selection in our field, especially because it's not a core rotation for medical school. And so people do have to kind of seek it out. I mean, we've made strides in other areas. And one of the things you've written about in editorials for the Academy and done some research into has been this idea of how can we increase representation, not just of underrepresented minorities, but also of women. We've really progressed to a stage now that we have more female residents entering ophthalmology than we do a male. And that's true for medical schools in the U.S. as well. But if you look at leadership positions, and there's been studies done, we did a study from here, one of my terrific medical students looking at program directors. People have looked at chairs in the U.S. We've looked at editorial boards, industry relationships, and there's still a pretty big gender gap that needs to improve as we go forward in the future. I mean, you've kind of seen the full evolution of where we've gone in terms of gender equity in ophthalmology over the last 25, 30 years. Where do you think we are today, and what kind of lessons from the past can we use to continue getting better? And how can we really position the next generation of women to take leadership roles in ophthalmology and give them the opportunities to make a more equal playing field?
I think it's there are a lot of ways, but it's not an easy fix. And in some ways, I think it's harder now than it was for me. Not as overtly. So when I was a first year resident, for the first time ever at Wilmer, there were two female residents in the class of five. And I remember Ron Michaels coming down to the ER when I was down there with my friend Patty Smith, who was the other female resident. And he looked at us and he goes, "Wow, the whole residency is female, isn't it? We are just going to be an all-female residency." And we kind of looked at him like, it's 2 out of 5, 3 out of 15.
Right.
Not so much.
Not quite.
So people don't say that anymore. But I was the first female chief resident. I was the first, female fellow Ron had ever taken. So who was a full-time fellow. He'd had some visiting fellows from other countries and things like that. But so I had the advantage of feeling kind of pioneering and also being able to get my backup when people said that. Now everybody goes, "Oh, well, I think this year more than half the medical school students that enrolled were female. We tend to have at least half of our residents being female." We had a class a few years ago where 7 of the 8 were female. But as you so astutely point out, it breaks down as things go on to the next level, and in leadership positions, we are behind. It is getting better. I was one of the only female chairs, and I noticed I'm flying out to the AUPO meeting tomorrow morning, and I saw that we have two more female chairs on top of the six or eight that we've now got. So there is more leadership there. And I think as we get more people at those levels, then we will tend to suggest our friends who are female the way guys have suggested their friends who are male all along. Just well-meaningly. You know, you really have to stretch yourself and reach outside your comfort zone in order to cast a wider net and think, you know, who are the people that would be good to nominate for this role that are not like me? You know, are there who train other places? Because when somebody asks you, like if somebody asks you right now, I need to get somebody to give a comment on this new study that just came out in the New York Times, and off the top of your head, you had to say somebody, you would probably say somebody you were friends with, because
right.
That's just who you would think of. You wouldn't rack your brain for somebody who has a totally different background from you that you kind of heard about somewhere in the Southwest. You know, you probably wouldn't do that. So we need to consciously think about that, and then we also need to educate young women, and this tends to underrepresented minorities, to understand what the barriers they face are and to not get discouraged by them and to be expecting them. So if they, get called on or get off their lower salary or the other things that we know from lots and lots of data that are out there now, that they're ready for that and they respond in a positive way and not take it, not get discouraged, not get derailed. And actually, those techniques are good for everybody. They're good for men. They're good for, you know, the Caucasians who have run the specialty too. And I think all of these will be positive, ultimately, for everyone. I know Redonda is the new female president of Hopkins Hospital. There's never been a female before. And one of the things her staff, and who are a lot male, are so happy about is that, you know, she's the first person they've ever worked for at that level who will actually say, I'm going to have to leave at 3 because my son in second grade has a play at 4. You know, I mean, back in the day, first of all, the fathers wouldn't go, only the mothers would go, and the mothers would sneak out pretending that there was some emergency or something. But now it's just out there that it's okay to do that. And I think it really makes for a healthier environment in general.
Perfect. Well, Dr. Haller, you've been super generous with your time. I really appreciate you coming on the program and sharing super insightful stories. We can all learn from some great stories. And we, like you said, we could talk for another 4 hours. But I want to take away from your time. I know you're very busy. Up at Will's, and enjoy the AUPO meeting. Have a great trip and be safe.
Thanks so very much, Jay. Thanks for doing all this. I think everybody really is loving your whole series.
Thanks so much. Have a great trip, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Remember, you can find this and other podcast episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. We have all 214 episodes there sorted by category. You'll also find links on the website to get subscribed to our mailing list, and that will give you updates on the most recent episodes as they come out. Remember that you can find us on Facebook and on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and you can find us in the Apple and Android store, and that's how I subscribe to get the episodes each week coming to my phone. In terms of how you can reach us, remember you can reach us at retinapodcast.com. You can also email us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. And we look forward to feedback. That helps us define what episodes we like to focus on, what episodes maybe you didn't find as high yield. And we love positive feedback in the form of reviews on our website or in the Android or Apple store. Thanks to Dr. Julia Haller and for joining us for this episode. Drs. Michael Benicasso, Angela Chang, and Louis Kai, who put together this episode, and all the company social media. And thank you, listeners, for the patient care you provide on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
feeling?
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.